Coming up on this week's show, a one-of-a-kind Ridge Racer cabinet could be saved.
The best geeky Christmas jumper ever.
And we chat Might and Magic plus Medal of Honor with Tim Lang.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our great friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their best books they've brought out recently, The Games That Weren't. Now, this is years in the making. The Games That Weren't reveals a story of more than 80 video games that were caught in production hell and ended up in gaming limbo. So you can buy that right now and check out the rest of their retro gaming books on their website at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 354, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, the podcast that, of course, every Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the golden age of video games. We bring you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last week and, of course, in the second half of the show. This is where we really come into our own, and we bring you a veteran of the industry onto the show to tell you the story of their career and these incredible games that they worked on. And today we've got an amazing guest to tell you about. But I'm pretty shocked that we are now doing our final show of November. Not only does that mean we are literally weeks away from one of our biggest episodes of the year, the Retro Hour annual Christmas Super Quiz.
Oh, God.
I'm particularly nervous because I'm actually a contestant on the quiz this year.
Oh, God, yeah, I wouldn't want to be the guy who's paired up with you, mate.
That's you, mate.
Don't join my
we
team.
Won last time.
I've got a losing streak.
We won last time we were together, didn't we, Joe, I think?
Oh, we did, we did. This is true. So, good.
I carried your own.
I'm going to have to get an expert on to come in and destroy you people. I'm going to go for like a professional quiz person.
He's going to come on with like one of the guys from, oh God, The Chase or something.
Yeah, Bradley Walsh.
The Beast. I'm getting The Beast on.
So that is coming up in just a couple of weeks' time as we get into our festive programming, the best of the year as well. But of course, before that, there is something rather big that's happening right now. And when this episode drops, we are literally right in the middle of our Kickstarter campaign for the Retro Hour book. And I've got to say, I mean, the first 2 weeks have absolutely blown me away. The amount of love, the amount of support, the amount of nice comments, the amount of people that seem genuinely as excited to get hold of this book as we are.
Yeah, man, it's been, it's crazy kind of like waking up in the morning or, you know, like overnight or whatever, because obviously you've got listeners all around the world and people backing us from all around the world, just like with all the nice comments. Like there's been so many people saying so many nice things, and I feel a bit repetitive, like going on and on about it or just saying the same thank you. But I'm worried like people don't think it's sincere, if that makes sense. But it really is, like I wake up and it's just like, it's amazing to check it and kind of respond to everybody. And you know, I'm kind of doing my best on socials to say thank you to each and every person who kind of even just checks it out, you know, and says they checked it out or whatever, or gives it a thumbs up. But like, it is, we're really, really, really blown away by it. And it's been a roller coaster. Like, it's really, really thrilling, but it's really scary. Like, I think we're 83% of the way now with 2 weeks to go. So we are close.
I mean, and a Kickstarter is—it's all or nothing, isn't it? If we don't hit that 100%, it doesn't happen.
Yeah,
it's like everyone doesn't get charged. Obviously, I'll just put that out there.
You know? It's like kind of, you know, interesting in an idea, but when it gets funded, it becomes real, and that's absolutely awesome. And I can't believe that we've got this far as well. Yeah, I just, you know, really appreciate it. It's amazing. Like so far, 429 backers. You know, that's how many people are interested in getting this like hardback. But what is it though, Dan?
Yeah, because I mean, that's the thing. We know that not everyone listens to every single episode. We get people jumping in just because they're really interested in that this week's guest, for example. So quickly, just to recap, we're doing a book that contains 10 of our favourite interviews from over 350 that we've done on this podcast. And the book is called The Retro Hour, The History of Video Gaming from Those That Made It Happen. Now, the thing is, we wanted to make this a real celebration of some of our favourite guests that we've had on the show. And it is going to be an absolutely gorgeous, full-colour, premium hardback book, over 400 pages. And we were saying this a couple of weeks ago that, you know, obviously we've ran these podcasts on the show, but we're going to expand them with box outs, extra information, commentary. There's going to be 10 features throughout the book as well. When we do get funded, which I'm pretty confident is going to happen, there's going to be a couple of stretch goals as well to get exclusive extra interviews and content in the book. And I'd say about, you know, maybe 40% of the book is going to be images too. So we've worked with an independent photographer we've hired to take images for the book. We've been checking out some of our favorite images online, working with people on Flickr, people who've documented shows, have been to these guest houses, took pictures of the machines, and we've licensed gorgeous images for the book as well. And obviously, the more that we raise on Kickstarter, the more that we can spend on licensing these beautiful images as well. So in the book, I mean, we've got just some of our favorite guests, and I mean, it was hard to pick just 10, really, wasn't it, out of 350? But give us some of the highlights of these 10 people we've picked then.
Some of the highlights. Well, let's see how quick I can do this then. So we have got, you know, the granddaddy, the grandfather of video games, Nolan Bushnell in there, which is just was episode 100, absolutely massive episode.
Yeah,
we've also got, you know, classic TV UK TV and games master host Dominic Diamond in there, which is absolutely awesome. Founder of Shiny Entertainment, David Perry, worked on Earthworm Jim, Aladdin, Cool Spot. It was really cool hearing all about those Disney games and stuff that he worked on. The Yak himself, Jeff Minter, of course, you know, huge in the UK, huge around the world. One of my favorite interviews we've ever done. Trip Hawkins is going to be in there. We've been talking with Trip. We've got some, you know, some cool images and stuff as well to go in there. Al Nilsson, Sega marketing legend, you know, helped launch the Mega Drive, my favorite console of all time. Ken Williams, founder of Sierra Online, you know, got to have Sierra in there, haven't you?
Oh, too right.
Ed Smith, unsung black video game pioneer, which Ravi did a couple of years ago. Really, really, really interesting interview that was. Of course, John Bird, which did give us a lot of her attention. Sega's former director of development technology, and he helped design the Dreamcast. That episode, quite a bit of media attention, really, really, really
interesting. Wasn't it the worst video game bug ever?
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
We titled that. Yeah, that was such an incredible title.
Getting that documented in the book. And then one of my favorite interviews of all time, maybe even my most favorite one that I've ever been on, maybe the funniest one I've ever been on, Wild Bill Steely, who was the MicroProse co-founder, who's just a really, really exciting, fun character. In his interview, you know, hopefully we kind of captured that hilarity, you know, in the book as well. It was really, really fun.
I think it's going to be a good book for like anybody that wants to know about video game history, but also all the systems that are mentioned in this as well. You know, you've got like Jeff Minter in there. He talks about the Konix multi-system for a bit. You know, there's not many books that are going to be covering that, as well as the Dreamcast, as well as, you know, Sierra Online, and just a variety in there as well. And we've also got this dust jacket coming on the way from David Rowe at the moment.
Which should be out by now, actually. There should be a glimpse of that on our Kickstarter by the time this show comes out, hopefully.
Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, so David Rowe, you might know him. He did all, you know, the dungeons on the TV show Nightmare back in the day. Populous, he did the cover of that game. James Pond with a Bullfrog Psygnosis. Melbourne House Firebird as well. So honestly, we want to make this book just something that we can be really proud of. And that's something that is just going to look gorgeous on your shelf or your coffee table. And will be a nice momentum that can live on forever. You know, this collection of these incredible interviews all together in one book. And it has got a foreword from a retro gamer journalist and good friend of the show, Mr. Paul Drury. And we've got loads of rewards as well for those who can back a little bit extra money too. So if you want to check all of those out and back the book, you know, we haven't got long left now. We've got only just 2 weeks left on this to make it happen. If you'd like to support it, of course, all the details and the link to the Kickstarter, you will find it on our website at theretrohour.com. And thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts to everyone who's helped us make this a reality so far. Let's do this. Right, coming up in a minute, we are going to be talking some of the big news stories this week, but also we have got an incredible guest as well, and you guys did this one. I've got to say, I was literally on the edge of my seat listening to this interview, hanging off every word. What a guest we've got this week.
It was really interesting. So there's two Tim Langs in the world. There's the graphics Tim Lang. We're not talking to him today. We're talking to the programming Tim Lang. And he actually came from New World Computing, which is a really interesting company because they got took over by 3DO, the games company, just as they were kind of going into the Might and Magic series from number 6 to number 9. And then later on, you know, Tim tells us all about Medal of Honor as well. And the kind of, you know, we've not really covered Medal of Honor or the later FPSs and just the realism in that series. And, you know, you see stuff like Call of Duty nowadays, you know, absolutely dominating. And back then, I was a huge Medal of Honor fan. So it's a really interesting interview. And Might and Magic as well. What a weird, weird kind of RPG series that was. I really loved it. I had a lot of fun elements in that game.
Yeah, it was a really fun interview. And like you say, it's really cool kind of hearing about his journey from going, you know, programming and designing levels and stuff like that for RPGs, you know, and kind of the whole kind of, you know, sword and sorcery world to then kind of get thrown into Medal of Honor and kind of like the things he had to go through, which I don't want to spoil, you know, which in some ways were really fun for him and really interesting to kind of like then work on such a huge shooter. And as you say, Medal of Honor, kind of before Call of Duty, was probably the dominant big, you know, FPS, like you say, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was really interesting to hear his story about working on them. And then, you know, he kind of touches on then kind of like how Call of Duty kind of came from that, which was really cool as well.
Yeah, and I loved your interview with him as well. I just think he had such fun doing it. Mm. You guys just all got on so well. It's such a giggle as well through it. So some really interesting stories with our special guest, Tim Lang. He'll be coming up on the show in around 25 minutes from now. But of course, before we do that, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week. And thank you to everyone who shared this story with us. Loads of people put it in our Discord, people tagging me on Twitter, sending me on Facebook as well. A beautiful story that actually comes from the new Derby Computer Museum of a teenager who, like many of us did back in the day, I mean, I've got memories of getting my Amiga 500 Plus for Christmas 1991. You know, I love playing Lemmings, Captain Planet, The Simpsons, you know, sat down playing all those games. But one memory that really sticks in my mind is opening Deluxe Paint and trying to do computer art or animations. I mean, I was never very good at it, but the fact that I could do it was always incredible. But there's a kid here, a guy called Richard McFarlane, who sadly passed away when he was 17 years old back in 1991. And it turns out they've actually found some art that he made on his Amiga back then, and this has now been preserved.
Yeah, so this is really quite sweet. So after he passed away, his kind of computer and everything got put up in the loft. And then over the years, you know, they took it to some computer shops and stuff like that to try and sell. And essentially, the shops didn't want it. They said it wasn't worth it. It was an Amiga 500, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what shops they were going to.
Yeah, I know. But it's a good thing because it's a very sweet story. And essentially, when the museum announced that it was opening, the Derby Computer Museum in Chellerston, pretty much his mum thought, you know, maybe they will want it. Maybe I'll donate it to them. And she didn't expect anything of it. And essentially, they contacted her recently. And they'd managed to find, they'd got the computer up and running and found all the artwork that he had made and created, you know, in 1991. And they actually made an entire exhibit of part of the museum in its own, like, delegated room, haven't they?
Yeah.
And he invited his mum and his family to come and see it before the opening. And apparently it was really emotional for them, which I think is really lovely that they did this. And then they also actually printed his work off. And framed it and gave it to them, which I think, I mean, I'm welling up a little bit about it now, but I might be because I'm a dad now. But I can just imagine how emotional and how nice of a gesture that is.
It's really nice how, like, you know, someone's artwork can, like, live on and just stay on that system and then be recovered, like, later, you know, after being in the loft. I think if it had gone to a shop or something and just got sold, it would have just got wiped or lost. But this shows real care and effort by the museum. And this is a brand new museum as well in Derby, which is really cool. We've got to pay a visit there. You know, just being local, just down the road, we'll have to check it out. But I'm really surprised by Richard's artwork. Like, he's really high end, you know. One of the demos on the CDTV was like dinosaurs and stuff at the beginning. And he's got a really awesome landscape here. And, you know, he's done a lot better than I could ever do on D-Paint when I was younger. Some really impressive stuff. So I think this is great. And that, you know, he's living on through his art in this.
Yeah, of course, we had that famous story a couple of years ago that Andy Warhol's artwork was recovered from an Amiga as well, and that was displayed in a museum. So, and I'm looking here, and, you know, when Richard passed away, he's 17 years old. When I got my Amiga, I mean, I used to try and do graphics and stuff when I was a kid and teenager. And yeah, he's done some here, like, you know, the dinosaur and a volcano image. All I could do in Deluxe Paint was like stick men.
Yeah.
But these graphics he did are like, yeah, they're gorgeous, full color, beautiful detail in them too. There's like an outer space image that looks incredible as well. So the fact that now you can walk into this museum in Derby and actually check out an exhibition from Richard McFarlane, who passed away in 1991, his family can walk in and see it at any time, and they're running on his original Amiga as well, I just think is really beautiful.
And I love, there's a gallery of his pictures here, and there's this geometric kind of images. Do you remember that? There was a special mode that you could go on Deluxe Paint and you could draw like in geometry and do these weird patterns and stuff like that. He's done them much better than I did. I would just go crazy with it. But that kind of takes me back to those Deluxe Paint days as well.
Yeah, so if you want to check out those images, and we'll put a link to the new Derby Computer Museum, you'll find all that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, this next one is a bit of a long story, but I'm trying to condense this because this actually resonated quite a lot with me. You know, I've talked about on the podcast before that Ridge Racer is, if not my all-time favourite arcade racing game, it is definitely up there in my, you know, top two or three. And I've got memories of playing it when I was about like 13, 14 at my local bowling alley.
Yeah.
And the one I remember is it was actually the Ridge Racer full scale.
Right.
So we had like it was a car you sat in.
Yeah.
And there was a massive rear projection screen in front of you.
Yeah.
They had speakers around it. There's even fans, I remember, that kind of made, you know, wind when you were driving.
How much ago was that?
Well, that would have been about, I think it was about £2 to play on in 1994, 95.
Okay.
So that was quite a lot, you know, for an arcade game back then. And it was weeks. It was a place called Teesside Park that's still there now in Middlesbrough. When it just opened, actually, and there's like a bowling alley there, there's big cinema screens and stuff there too. But they did have a really cool little arcade bit. I remember playing Virtua Fighter and stuff there for the first time. But this Ridge Racer machine, the fact that it was actually a real car, that to me was like, you know, the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that. I mean, I kind of played the Outrun ones, you know, that kind of, you know, simulate a car a bit, but nothing like this. This is actually a real Mazda MX-5. That they just kind of, you know, stripped all the car bits out of and actually made it into a controller for the game. So that was very cool. And it turns out that, I mean, there's a full story in this blog on arcadeblogger.com. They kind of talks about this Ridge Racer cabinet. And it turns out that they reckon there's only one surviving example in the world now. But there was quite a lot of these back in the day. But the fact that they were so difficult to install means that none of them have really survived.
I also guess the size of it being full scale, it's probably taken up the room for like 7 arcade machines.
Yeah,
so arcades probably just went, right, it's out of date, let's get rid of it and fill it up with, you know, money making machines.
Well, interesting you should say that. So when I was reading this article, I mean, either I didn't know or I'd completely forgot about the full scale one. For me, it was always either the stand up Ridge Racer or the one with the 3 CRT screens.
Yeah.
You know, and that's big enough. You know, the 3 CRT screen one. But like you say, Ravi, it refers to it as a cabinet the whole way through, but it's more like a ride. You know, it's like an experience.
It's like a garage. You've basically got the car in the middle and then it's got a full surround around it.
And like you say, it turns out reading this article, you know, as you say, it takes up like so much space. It costs £250,000 to buy the cabinet. And what would happen is Namco would come and they wouldn't just send you the cabinet. They'd send you like the car and the kit and everything, but they would actually come over to you and they would have the space and they would figure out how to build the cabinet into the space. So it was specifically built for all the space that you had.
So they're all different.
Yeah. Which is really interesting. So the game, the screen and the car are all the same, but the actual kind of like housing to it, if that makes sense, is different for everybody. And as you know, Ravi says, it's taken up so much room and it was made in 1993. So I guess by the late 90s, early 2000s, it would be quite a dated game and it's taken up a lot of room.
Imagine the lift that you'd need, like a lift that you'd have to drive a car in.
It's an actual car. So yeah, they think there's one left in the world, which was at Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Pleasure Beach is actually a theme park, which I am, which I've not been to since I was about 10 years old.
I used to spend a lot of time at Pleasure Beach. And if there's anything that's broken down or old, or from
that's
the
where
90s,
it'll be.
It will be at the Pleasure Beach. Yeah, still going. You know?
You probably saw this, yeah, because I mean, it looks like it was running from about 94, 95 and actually only shut down back in around 2017, 2018.
Yeah, so maybe in the depths of my brain, because my family are from Blackpool and I went to Pleasure Beach a lot, it was there. But yeah, in 2017, they closed it off, but they actually, funny enough, Ravi, you would love this. You should go look for this picture. They actually just put arcade machines in front of it, like to close it, because they couldn't because they couldn't really like remove it. But this is where the story gets a bit crazy. So there's a kind of a lot of like posts and articles about it. And sometimes is it true? Does it kind of match up? But the National Video Game Museum allegedly offered to take it away from them and put it in the museum. And they kind of had to do a few official statements around it because of they pretty much, it turned out, they never actually took it, did they? They never actually...
They figured it was more effort than it's worth.
Yeah.
No, they wanted it. They wanted it, but apparently a private collector beat them to it, which is kind of where the story goes weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Because
this guy got it and then he just kind of...
Left it.
Abandoned it?
Yeah.
His living room, wasn't it?
No, it's worse than that, unfortunately. So they dismantled it, took it away from Pleasure Beach, and then screenshots of it appeared online of the car and the screen and some of, like, you know, the kind of like the PCB boards and stuff in his garage. But then the actual structure of, you know, the Ridge Racer full scale, like, like all the structures and artwork and stuff just got left in the garden under tarpaulin and wasn't like tied down. So it all went rusty and, you know, it was just kind of left to the British elements. And then it turned out the garage had a really bad leak in it as well. And it leaked all over the PCB boards and completely destroyed them. So there was a bit of an outcry because of everybody thinks this, as far as we know, this is the last known one in the world. But then somebody, an anonymous source, has now appeared online in recent months and said they have bought the house off the person who had it and he'd left it in the garage. He got rid of all the marquee and the structure. That's all gone.
House comes with Ridge Racer full scale.
Has come with Ridge Racer full scale in the garage. Now, some people are saying it's just the guy trying to cover his tracks and he's just, you know, that's why he's posting anonymously and it could be the same guy. It's all speculation, stuff like that. But apparently he's managed to recover it. And now this is where, Dan, you might have to help me. I'm not too sure who it's with now, but it's now been donated. And essentially, they've managed to restore it. The car is okay. The PCB boards are destroyed, but they're using emulation. They've managed to emulate. Somebody's been working on it, and they're emulating the game to work on the screen. Is that right?
Yeah, so apparently they already had like kind of quite a bit of it working in emulation. But there was about, I think there was 8 chips that hadn't been emulated on there, but now they've managed to get most of it up and running again.
Yeah.
And they reckon that, you know, between kind of remaining examples of different ones and, you know, there might be like a bit of the kind of structure left over from another one. They basically reckon between them, they might have enough now to actually have a fully restored one up and working at some point.
Right.
Well, hopefully it will go to a place that's not going to go bust and then hide it again for another load of years. You know, hopefully it'll be in a place where it's quite permanent, which is good because I can imagine it's such a faff to get it in there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it would be great. I mean, I'm not sure. Again, I mean, you can read this blog and it's very, very long, isn't it? And it goes into much more detail than we've got time to talk about on the show. But yeah, I mean, the National Video Game Museum were interested, kind of had their involvement. Right now, I'm not really sure. It's, you know, depends on which source that you read. But it would be great if, you know, maybe they can work with these people who've now finally got their hands on it all and are working on restoring it and eventually get it displayed in there. I think that will be incredible. So everyone can come and have a go on it again. I mean, I've just got, I mean, such vivid memories of playing on that as a teenager and just being blown away by it. I'd love to experience it again.
Dan, you need it in your garage.
Yeah. I would build another garage just for this. So, yeah, it does look incredible. So if you want to see that, I mean, obviously, I'm sure there's going to be more news about that over the next year or two, but it looks like it's in the hands of the correct people now. So I'll put a link to that blog in our show notes at theretrohour.com. A bit of an update on the Streets of Rage movie. Now, we did talk about this probably about a year ago, didn't we? That Streets of Rage movie looks like it's in the works from John Wick creator Derek Kolstad, who's apparently working on this movie. Apparently, there's been a bit of a script written from what we heard. And it looks like now, though, that actually a big company have picked it up. And there are some people with some big pedigree in turning video games into movies behind it now.
Yeah, so I'm sure it was within the last year at least we were talking about this, that this was in the works. But essentially, it's looking as though the Streets of Rage movie is going to happen. So Lionsgate have picked it up, haven't they?
Massive distributor.
They've picked up the rights to it. And because of that, a few more people have got on board with the project. So Kolstad's going to be joined by...
Ryan Reynolds.
it's not Ryan Reynolds. It's
Chris Pratt.
Not Chris Pratt either. Okay. Maybe.
We don't know who's in it yet.
But Toru Nakahara, who previously worked and produced the only two Sonic movies. So he's involved with it. And then also a company called DJ2. which are a company that specialise in adapting gaming properties for the cinema, who also worked with the Sonic team, you know, to make the Sonic films. So it looks like it is going to happen and it's picking up traction. No kind of like release date or like, you know, if Ryan Reynolds or Chris Pratt are going to be in it, but I wouldn't be surprised. I should say, Randy. But yeah, it looks as though it is probably going to happen because I think, like you said, Dan, last we heard, there was a script flying around.
Yeah.
Now we've actually got a distributor and we've got companies involved in making it happen. You know,
and Sega involved as well, which is like
Sega involved, obviously. So I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I'm thinking it's got to be like quite a serious kind of martial arts street fight kind of film for me.
They could,
I don't
they
want
could
it to
kind
be silly.
Of go Cobra Kai.
They could go Cobra Kai.
Well, there is. Interestingly, if you look on, I'll put this link in our show notes as well. There's a website called WeGotThisCovered.com, and they're actually talking about who they reckon would be the perfect actors to play the roles in Streets of Rage. And actually, they reckon the role of Axel Stone, William Zabka, who plays Johnny Lawrence in Karate Kid and Cobra Kai, would be a good choice for that. I mean, actually, he does look quite like him, I think. He's got that definitely the look of it.
He's definitely got the look of it, but it depends where they want to go with it. If they want to do it as if, like, because William Zabka's like maybe 57, something like that.
Which, as we were saying before, Axel Stone would be about that
age.
He
would be about that
age.
So if they were doing it as like, it's set in 2022, 23 or whatever, and it is like the Streets of Rage characters from the games in the 90s, then that would be the right age for them. Mm. But funny you should say that. If they're going to go ahead and do it like when they were young, the person who plays his son in Cobra Kai, I think he would make a good Axel.
Come to think of it.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was Ryan Reynolds and Chris Pratt.
You need Brian Blessed as one of the bosses. That would be good.
Oh, yeah, that would be good.
I love this article as well on trueachievements.com, and they're talking about, you know, the fact that the game's going to feature them kind of running down the street, punching loads of people that look exactly the same and eating stuff that they find in a bin.
Will it have leather-clad ladies with whips?
I hope so. We'll see.
It's not Streets of Rage otherwise, is it? Come on. So, very cool. I mean, it just seems like, you know, obviously with the new Mortal Kombat movie as well, hopefully not too far away now, the second installment of that. It does kind of feel like games coming to the big screen. It's finally been done right. We haven't seen any really neff ones for a couple of years.
They're saving them all, they just don't give as much attention.
We just swerved them. So, and we've got some big news actually about something that's going to be coming back to the small screen in just a minute to tell you about, and probably the coolest ugly Christmas jumper you will see this year. Before we do that, though, just a quick shout that obviously it is a final weekend of the month, and you know what that means. Sunday night is a big one, our favourite Sunday of the month. It is patrons' hangout time. Anyone? Do you know?
I was scrambling. I was like, is it the last Sunday of the month? It bloody is.
It is.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's this Sunday coming. Gosh, better tell the missus.
This month has gone quick.
I better tell the missus that the credit card's going to get hammered while I'm online with the boys. No, always super excited. Unfortunately, I missed the last one because I was at work. I've got a new job. I do have to do some night shifts with it. And it was one of the night shifts. But they have promised me the last Sundays of the month. They know that I do the Patreon hangout, and that comes first moving forward, so I will be there on this one. So super excited to hang out with everybody and say hello to everybody, because for me it has been 2 months, and you guys even said that the last one was probably one of the best ones we ever did and the busiest one you've ever did. Like, they must have known I wasn't going to be there.
I didn't want to mention that correlation, Joe.
I know.
I'm sure it was just coincidence.
And I'm really glad we do it on a Sunday, because then it can be like a hungover hangout for me as well.
Are you out on Saturday night?
Oh, yeah, cousin's birthday, so that's going to be fun.
Bit of hair of the dog, Ravi, you'll be fine, isn't it, Christmas? So we're doing that on Sunday night. If you haven't joined us for one before, it's so much fun. A load of us get together, we just completely nerd out. You know, we chat about our pickups, we do room tours, show off our gaming stuff. We give advice as well. You know, we've loads of times on there, people have asked for, you know, tips on software installations, you know, restoring old hardware. Just a bit of a geek out for a couple of hours, really informal. If you'd like to join us for that, it's coming up on Sunday night. All you got to do is back us on Patreon. All patron tiers are welcome to that. And also this weekend, we will be recording our next episode of our patrons exclusive podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours. Now, on the current episode, you can check out, and I think you unlock almost 30 back episodes if you join us on there now. We've done a load of them, and that was we go through our favorite video game add-ons So we're talking about peripherals, you know, mega CDs and all that kind of thing. So about an hour and a half episode. So if you want to check that out, loads of other perks as well for joining us on Patreon. But of course, the main reason you're doing it is just to make sure that we can keep the lights on and keep bringing this podcast to you each and every week. All the details to join us and get an invite to this weekend's hangout are at theretrohour.com. So our special guest, Tim Lang, talking about Might and Magic and Medal of Honor in just a minute. Before that, though, it turns out the next year, Games Master is coming back again.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the comeback. It's interesting. I've seen some press about it that's been like, it was awful and it got cancelled and all of this stuff. But I thought it went down quite well.
I liked it.
Yeah, the Games Master.
So this was last year. I mean, for those outside the UK, Games Master, I'm sure you've heard us talking about it, huge, an institution of British gaming back in the early 90s to the late 90s, ran for about 8 years, I think. You can watch them all on YouTube if you're interested. Had a break for about 20-odd years and finally made a comeback last year with just 3 episodes. Completely different cast on there as well, but I think it did have a lot of that kind of Games Master attitude and legacy. And it did feel like what Games Master would have turned into, I think.
Yeah,
it definitely had that kind
of
DNA.
It's always been about like kind of participating and watching people play and having challenges and playing against each other. And a lot of the challenges seem to go on to like modern titles, but a lot of them weren't that modern. You had like Splatoon in there and stuff. But it was fun. They had a bit of stuff about history of gaming as well and legacy.
And I thought, you know, the style of the show reminded me of the original Games Master 2. So, you know, I think they definitely had all that right. You know, Rab Florence, who was a host of it, I thought he did a really good job as being like, you know, a Dominic Diamond
replacement. And it was very much a test, wasn't it? It was very much a pilot and then kind of putting their toes in the water and going like, is this going to flow? How's it going to go down with people? And to be honest, I saw there was mixed reactions. You know, a lot of people wanted it to be more retro and stuff like that. I get that. But, yeah, it's interesting to see that it's kind of been commissioned again. And I guess they're going to extend it, probably have more episodes than 3.
Yeah, I mean, they did those 3 and apparently it reached 152 million views, which, you know, for 3 episodes is really good. We obviously had Trevor McDonald.
No, 152 total impressions, which is very different to 150.
Across social media as well.
Yeah, which is very different to 150 million views, because I don't think anything on mainstream television gets that these days. And interestingly, they actually put it out on YouTube as well.
I was going to say, it was mostly on YouTube, wasn't it? It was on there first before it was on TV. And Trevor McDonald played the Games Master. I thought he did a great job. But now they're saying that, yes, it looks like it was a success enough to be kind of commissioned for a new series of it, hopefully with more episodes. Although this time, they're saying they are going to make some changes. Now, this is a bit that I've got a feeling people of our generation who enjoyed the last one, who kind of wanted a bit of that kind of legacy in there as well, we might get a bit nervous at this. Now, they're saying that they want to take things even further with this. And this time, they don't want to appeal to the nostalgic fans of it, but they want to really aim this at a younger audience and people that are totally unaware of the original series. So what they want to do is make this something that appeals to the gaming ecosystem on Channel 4 social platforms. And it means they're actually going to unapologetically aim this at a young social first audience.
I can imagine that's happening with everything, you know what I mean? But I can imagine they'll do it all right. It's not going to be like totally abandoning its roots, because that would be, you know, that wouldn't go down well with anyone. I think they'll still have the roots, the style of it and stuff, but aim it for that new audience, because as long as they're not selling NFTs and doing stuff like that, you know, I'll be down with it. Yeah, I quite enjoyed the one. I thought Rab was a really good host to have on the show. I hope he's back. And Frankie Waterlight and Ty as well. Ty did seem very aimed at the young audience, though. And
Trev McDonald, I thought, was great. Obviously, Patrick Moore passed away a lot of
years. Yeah, Games Master,
So I think, you know, from what I really enjoyed those episodes, and I thought that had the right balance of appealing to original fans and new ones as well. So it would be nice if they did just kind of keep that format going with the same people. I think it would work for a full series, but
yeah, I don't understand the use of today. So maybe there's something that they can do that will appeal to both groups. But that's very hard to try and get something that's going to appeal to kids as well as middle age. And people say, yeah, we'll see. We'll
see.
I
think they got the balance right. I think they got it right because my little nephew, his 10, he loved it.
Did he love it?
He watched that with his dad. Yeah, him and his dad watched it together. They both loved it. So it kind of felt like they straddled that kind of old school, new school thing quite well.
And you weren't forcing him to watch it. No, you'll love this.
Matchsticks in his eyes, rope around him so he couldn't get up off the seat. I'm hoping they kind of just continue with what they did last time and don't make too many changes.
The good thing is that they're actually considering games output, and I don't think they've considered games output on mainstream television or any of the channels have for a long time. And it's such a big industry. They need to address it and need to get involved. So if they can do it through a bit of nostalgia and then, you know, increase that kind of output and get into that games area, I think it's a good place to go.
You know, it's funny, isn't it? Because back in the day, it felt like, you know, having games coverage on TV made kind of gaming relevant. Now it feels like the other way around, doesn't it? Like gaming's making television relevant.
Yeah, totally. Swapped. Yeah. Like, let's get on this gaming vibe. Okay. Could bring more people back to the old format.
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on that as we hear more. Apparently it's going to be coming back next year. Have you guys got a Christmas jumper ready for your Christmas bash this year? You having a Christmas party? I work from home now. I think I'm having one.
My new work have a Christmas party, and we're having it at like a really posh venue. And it literally says if you don't wear smart trousers or a suit, you'll be turned away. So maybe if I turn up in this garish jumper that you found for us, Dan, they might let me in.
Well, I've got to admit, I do love my NAF Christmas jumpers.
Oh God, yeah.
And Microsoft have actually been releasing a few of them over the last few years. I don't know if you saw this. They did a couple of years back, they did a pattern with the Windows logo, kind of Windows 3.1 and MS Paint logos on there as well. Last year it was Minesweeper that they put on a jumper.
I've seen a teletext one. That was pretty cool.
Yes. Yeah. I've seen that on my Facebook feed coming up as well. Now, there are a lot of these kind of things around these days. But this one, Microsoft this year, have released an official Clippy Christmas jumper. Now, you remember Clippy.
Or Clip-It, as he was known.
Clip-It was actually his real name, but for some reason, everyone calls him Clippy.
I remember him and I hate him. it was when they introduced this kind of tooltip kind of thing. And, you know, it came in different forms. They had a William Shakespeare as well. They had a Power Pup, which was another one. Office logo that you could talk to. And it was just basically an annoying assistant. So it was designed not for pro office users like us. It was designed for new users, and he'd pop up and be really annoying. And there's a reason why we don't have Clippy anymore in this.
Well, actually, do you know that Clippy survives in Windows 11?
I was going to say, he's in Windows 11, isn't he?
Is he the assistant? I'm a Mac user, so I've escaped Clippy.
I didn't realize this, but I have got a Windows 11 machine in my house, and I tried this. And if you if you open the emoji keyboard on Windows 11 and you search for the paperclip emoji, it is actually Clippy.
Oh, okay. So he's not just going to pop up and be like, activate your Windows.
Hey, it looks like you're writing a letter. No, he's not doing that anymore. But so basically this is a pretty hideous Christmas jumper, but I love the design of it, with Clippy there in the middle going, happy holidays. And there's the okay button that you'd always click to dismiss him. And there's a pile of papers in the background, kind of owing to his Microsoft Office legacy in there too. And apparently this is a proper knitted Christmas jumper, because you know a lot of these you see are just kind of sweatshirts with it kind of printed on.
Yeah.
But no, this is actually a proper wool knitted jumper with your old mate Clippy on there.
I hope so. At $75.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what they're going to do is Microsoft are donating $100,000 of the sales to the College Success Foundation, saying that they're giving a lot of the money to charity. But you joke there that this costs $75, and that's expensive. You click through to the site, and actually it is hosted on the Xbox Gear Store, and it looks like every single size of it is already completely sold out.
Oh, wow. Because you bought them all, Dan.
I wish I did. I think anyone that works in IT, you know, if you go to your IT Christmas party wearing one of these,
there's going to be system admins everywhere wearing these at office parties, you know, just turning up with Clippy, like, just to look cool.
Just wear it for the whole month of December.
Yeah. It does look pretty cozy, I've got to say. So, yeah, it's nice to see Microsoft kind of having a bit of, you know, tongue-in-cheek, a bit of a giggle with their legacy there as well. So they even call it a Windows ugly sweater.
You know what they need next? They need, like, safe to shut down on a T-shirt or something.
Well, it looks like they are doing these every year. It's a bit of an annual tradition now. And there is a little stock alert button on their website if you want to get alerted to if any more come in stock before Christmas. So I'll put that. And everything else we talk about, you'll find them all in our show notes on your podcast app or at theretrohour.com. Now, this week's special guest, Tim Lang, he's on the show in just a minute. Before we do that, let's take a quick moment to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and that is our incredible friends at ExpressVPN. Longtime supporters of the Retro Hour podcast, and you've probably heard us talk before about how important it is. And I think, you know, in the time that we've had ExpressVPN sponsor our show, it seems like it is increasingly more important to have a VPN to protect your online privacy.
Yeah, totally. There's so many different networks out there. I recently went to America and I couldn't get my card to work at all on the mobile phone network. So I was reliant on these Wi-Fi networks that I never connected to before at hotels, at airports, all over the place. And
that's always scary.
Yeah, very scary. And straight away, I had my laptop set so it would connect to ExpressVPN. And that was really awesome. And I really trust ExpressVPN. It doesn't log any of your activity. So it doesn't store anything. It's incapable of storing your data at all.
And one thing about ExpressVPN, I mean, you've been a long-term user of it as well, even before they sponsored our show. And they've got a thing called Lightway, which is a VPN protocol that makes your speeds faster than ever. Because, I mean, I'd used, like, free VPNs on that before. And, you know, I couldn't play HD video. Even normal video would stutter on some of the free VPNs. But ExpressVPN, super fast, isn't it?
Yeah, and you're really risky using those free VPNs as well, actually. Yeah. But yeah, it runs really well. And if you're streaming, you know, stuff from Netflix on another country or another location, you really want that HD quality.
Yeah, no buffering or anything like that. And dead simple to use. I know we've got it on our laptops. I've got it on my smart TV as well. Honestly, it's literally one tap of a button and you're connected as well. Even your grandparents could use this. So, and it's not just us who love ExpressVPN. Business Insider, The Verge, many other tech journals as well, they write ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with the VPN that we use and trust. And actually, if you use our exclusive link, we will give you 3 months of ExpressVPN for free on top of a one-year package. So head to this link right now and support the podcast by doing so. ExpressVPN.com/retro. Do that today. ExpressVPN.com/retro. And a big thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support of our show. So quick reminder, less than 2 weeks to go if you want to back the podcast book, the Retro Hour book that is now running on Kickstarter. We need to make this It's All or Nothing by, I think, December 10th it finishes. So we appreciate all your support so far. If you'd like to hold it in your hand, I've been fantasizing about this, Joe. Holding the book in my hand, how it's going to feel, because, you know, we've gone all out on this paper quality and everything, haven't we?
You texted me the other night saying how you've been fantasizing about holding it, and I've just got images of you, like, cuddling it in bed. Rolling around with it
and sniffing the book. Sniffing, I love the smell it. Of freshly
the new books. The new smell of it. But yeah, man, yeah. Like massive thank you. And we see the names. We know so many of our sales have been our Patreons as well, and we massively appreciate the ongoing support. You guys are really, really, really making it happen for us, which is just amazing.
Yeah, so everyone that's backed it so far, we cannot thank you enough from the bottom of our heart. We've got 2 weeks to make this happen. If you'd like to have the Retro Hour book in your hand and be able to hold it and sniff the pages like me, please join us on that Kickstarter right now, all the details, and have a look at the book as well. Check out the new dust cover. Hopefully we've got some images of that to show you by now. Check out all the amazing rewards. Get an exclusive episode of the podcast on an audio cassette tape. That is one of them. T-shirts, we've got all of that as well. You can check it out. And they're supported on Kickstarter. All the details are at theretrohour.com. Right then, this week's special guest, talking Might and Magic and Medal of Honor, Tim Lang is next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour, and we're here today with Tim Lang. And Tim's going to be telling us all about New World Computing, about the series Might and Magic, and also Medal of Honor. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. We always start our podcast with one question, and that was, what was your first gaming experience or your first memory of really playing a video game?
So I'm not sure if it particularly counts, but I remember being four or five, something around there. And my parents had a Coleco Telestar in their bedroom. And I snuck in there and I played Pong, and it had a light gun, played some shooting games. I don't remember being very good at it. So that's probably my very first gaming experience.
Did they catch you, or was that something that you did a lot, sneaking in to play, or was it a one-time thing?
I don't remember being caught, but I do remember doing it kind of a lot. And then, a few years later, my dad brought home an Intellivision, like out of the blue. And it wasn't like Christmas. It wasn't anybody's birthday. He showed up like, hey, here's an Intellivision.
Yeah.
I don't think he was particularly popular with my mom after that. but that's what really kicked off the gaming. I spent a lot of time on the Intellivision.
Yeah.
And then, moved on to the Commodore 64 as a teenager.
Oh, awesome. So our next question usually is what was your kind of like first home system or computer that you really sunk your teeth into? So would that be the C64? Did you have much experience programming on it?
Well, I wouldn't say much. I mean, I did a lot of programming on it, but I never finished anything. It was mostly like learning to do text adventure type games because they were easy to write, and messing around with the programs that came in the back of magazines and things like that. I did spend a lot of time with game creation tools. Adventure Construction Set was one where you could make your own RPG. And there was another one, Gary Kitchen's Game Maker. And I spent a lot of time with those, but just like programming my Zork clones, I never finished anything.
Well, yeah, I remember Gary Kitchen's Game Maker as well. Didn't he do Pitfall?
That was a game that was included with the Game Maker. I'm not sure if he was actually responsible for creating Pitfall in the beginning. He could be. I just don't know.
I was wondering then, did you have any like history of D&D at all? Or kind of getting into the RPG genre? Like, we've had a lot of developers on that always tell us, they were really into D&D.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I played a lot of it with my brother growing up, and occasionally I'd play with school friends, but mostly with my brother. My school friends were all into the AD&D, and I only did the basic edition at the time. I never learned. And that went through probably till I was 14 or 15. And then it stopped until I was like 25, and some friends of mine like, hey, you used to play. We're starting a campaign. And then we dove into it pretty hard after that for a long time.
So you kind of started your career with New World. What's the story there? How did you get the job with New World? What was the interview process like?
Yeah. So at the time, I was working at an answering service. I had a bright pink mohawk.
Nice.
And I had an old van or a car that wasn't exactly working, and I needed to find a job that paid better than the answering service. And I had a friend who worked at New World. And I was only kind of vaguely aware of who they were. I knew a couple of my other friends had worked in there or came and went and stuff like that. And so I just went and put in an application, just like a regular, like if you were applying for a job at a grocery store or a fast food or something, write all the things on the paper, no resume, no experience, and hand it in. And they called me in for an interview, and I had this pink mohawk, and I said, that's probably not going to cut it. So I wore a hat to the interview, which,
I don't know what's worse.
Yeah, it's a big no-no, but I was like, I figured that would be considered better than the mohawk.
Yeah.
And I was interviewed by two of the, I guess, lead testers. They didn't like officially have that title or anything. They were just, the two guys that interviewed me, and we just sat there and we talked about Commodore games. We talked about old PC games. We talked about, my experience with RPGs and D&D, and that was it. I told them when I was a kid, when I was on playing with a Commodore 64, I used to get the EA newsletter. And the newsletter always had these like back page stories that would talk about the wacky hijinks that they'd get into while they were in the office, you know, like shooting Nerf guns at each other and stuff.
Yeah.
Like. It's like, that's a fun place to work. One day I want to work at EA. And I told them that, and they said, well, you know, New World is owned by 3DO now. So it's kind of like working for EA. And I mean, eventually I did actually work for EA.
So it's an interesting time when you started then. What year was it?
It was, I think, 1996. So
1996. So they've been going since 86 as well. So were you aware of like all their previous titles?
You know, I wasn't. Series? I had never heard of Might and Magic until I sat down in that interview.
Yeah. So,
you ever played Might and Magic?
Best game ever.
Like, oh yeah, I loved it. No, I copped to it. I said, you know, I never played it, but you know, I did play a lot of Bard's Tale. That was one of my favorite games. And Might and Magic, Might and Magic 1 and Bard's Tale are very similar in like perspective and kind of gaming styles. So a lot of that kind of carried over, I think, in their opinions of me. Because I had to actually call back to get the job. Like, nobody called me. I called back like a week later or something and called the testing manager. And he's like, yeah, you got the job. When can you start? Tomorrow? You want to start tomorrow?
Oh, wow. Maybe they were just waiting for somebody to call back.
Yeah, right? The funny thing is, though, that you know, the guy who I replaced, he left the company with, I think, another tester to go follow around Grateful Dead.
Oh, wow.
All over the country. And I was like, oh, great. So I got my job. You know, I got a job because he left. And then like a few months later, Jerry Garcia died and the Grateful Dead stopped touring. So like, I never met him. Kind of feel bad for him that he quit a job making video games to do that. But, you know,
I guess a lot of people kind of quit jobs to go with Grateful Dead.
Yeah, that's true. And particularly in the game world, there's a lot of kind of flighty people like that, or at least when you're a tester.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
Like before, they were a developer and a publisher as well. So they were also just publishing other people's games as well. By the time you joined, it kind of started to shift into being a developer and a publisher.
Yep.
Totally as one. Was that a big kind of change? Did they have to get a lot of stuff in? And
So when I started, it was still, they were still publishing other people's games. And, you know, they were working on Heroes. They were working on a few ports of Heroes for the Mac and Heroes 1, I mean, and starting Heroes 2. Right after, my primary focus was on a project called Wages of War, which was a tactical turn-based strategy game in like XCOM or like Jagged Alliance, kind of right in between those two, I think. And when that game shipped and when Heroes 2 shipped and we were doing another game called Spaceward Ho 4, which was another sort of strategy game that was it was a space strategy game. Like the day after those shipped, 3DO stepped in and laid off all of the testers, including me. They laid off all the producers. They laid off basically anything that was sort of a publisher job. So they said, well, we have all this stuff up in Redwood Shores or Redwood City or wherever their home office was, Redwood City, I think. And so they laid all of us off and I was out for about 3 months-ish, two or 3 months. I remember planning to go back to school to get my degree in music, but I had to wait for the next semester to start because they laid me off right in between.
Yeah.
And so again, my car, you know, my car broke down and I needed to, I needed the money again. And I just out of the blue, I called Pete up, the test manager. And I said, hey, I need a job. And he's, okay, when can you start?
Oh, wow.
So it pretty much flipped from like a publishing studio to pure development.
Yep. Yeah. That when I got back, there was no, I thought I was coming back as a tester. And Pete sat me down in front of a computer not my old desk. I was very upset about that. Sat me down in front of a computer and gave me some sketches of like a building and some other like little things, some concept sketches, and showed me the Might and Magic 6 editor. And he says, okay, build these. See you later. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm not a tester.
I'm suddenly a level designer.
Exactly. Like there was no, we're bringing you back as a designer, where it was just like, here you go. And so after that, there was an in-house published or in-house producer for each individual project. And that was it. Mm. In fact, we were, when the level designers were finished with the level design of the game, we turned into testers. So we were responsible for the testing. I mean, there was testing at 3DO, but you know, no offense to those guys, but they sucked. So after that, they decided, you know, they wanted to keep us as level designers, but things were ramping up between, you know, Might and Magic 6 and then Might and Magic 7 and Heroes 3 and the Heroes 2 expansions. And so they decided they needed in-house testers, and the level designers couldn't do both jobs because we were busy on Heroes 3 or Might and Magic 7 or whatever. So then they hired on testers in addition and stuffed us all into this one big room.
So we're going to take it back in a moment, but I'm dying to ask. So when you've gone back and suddenly you're a level designer, were you terrified? How did that feel? Because of like, if that happened to me, I'd be like, what do I do? As soon as the doors closed, that kind of like Homer Simpson moment of like, what do I do? Yeah. What do I do? Like, I'm hoping or I'm assuming, you know, you had some sort of art ability. Like I'd be done like myself. What was that like? What happened? Yeah.
Well, okay. So I'm in your camp. I have zero art ability. Like if you ask me to draw something, it looks like a kindergartner did it.
Yeah.
But with 3D designs, I think I had I wouldn't say I had a gift, but I had been working with sort of 3D editors on my own in the past. Like I had the Wolfenstein editor, and I was making levels with Wolfenstein. There was the Bard's Tale construction set that I'd played around with that, and that kind of introduced me to game scripting and coding, and so a lot of that in-between experience when I was, you know, a teenager and in my early 20s of just playing around with creative stuff for games gave me kind of this step up. So I had a, well, you could say it a gift, but what, you know, it wasn't really a gift. It was just previous experience that I adapted well to that level design sort of thing. And the editor was pretty easy to pick up. Probably from my days of playing pirated games without manuals. It'll also be like, well, let's just push all the buttons and see what they do.
Just see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I love and Pete started us on easy stuff. So that helped us kind of learn the editor and things like that too.
I was going to say, were you nervous? But I'm guessing you did have some support. They did start you on easier stuff. So that's pretty good.
Yeah. And I didn't I didn't really have time to be like, I'm nervous about this because I'm going to be a level designer. Cause I didn't know. I just showed up and they're like, here you go. And
here you go. Deep end. Let's go. Yeah. I love that. So because we want to talk about it and we know some of the fans of the show will want to hear about it. I'm going to take you back to a few years before when you were still a tester. So you mentioned you started with Wages of War. Was that a unique title to kind of get your head around? What was that experience like?
I kind of picked that game as a tester, which you don't get to pick what game you're working on. But, you know, I told my boss I really loved XCOM. And so he's like, oh, perfect. Here you go on the turn-based strategy game. And it was kind of a unique title in like, you know, XCOM was very open worldy and, you know, randomized combat and stuff like that. But Wages of War had very specific levels in direct, like, you know, you finish this one, you go to that one, blah, 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 blah. But in terms of like the gameplay and the things you could do, there wasn't anything really innovative about it.
I think just the concept was a bit weird, wasn't it? That you're kind of, you know, hiring mercenaries against each other in a kind of business management sim. pretty odd.
The business management part of it was, it was kind of half-assed, honestly. It there was nothing very sophisticated about it. It was, you know, you earn money from your mission, and then you spend that money on better equipment, and that was pretty much the extent of its depth. You could pick cheaper guys and cheaper equipment and stuff like that, but there wasn't a lot. Like, you didn't have to negotiate contracts, really, that I remember. You didn't have to worry about other people stealing your bids or anything like that. So it was very much just earn money for the better loadout for the next mission.
Well, when you did get onto Might and Magic, it was Might and Magic 6.
Yeah.
And one of the features that I actually saw, one of the glitches, was like a level of basically the office and New World Computing, and it had a Trip Hawkins in the office, and you could go in. Where did that come from?
So that was my level, and Pete, the test manager / I think he might have been promoted to assistant producer or something like that. By then, he came in to me and he's like, "Hey, I want you to build the office as a secret level, and then fill it with all the employees and Trip Hawkins." and I said, "All right." And it's funny because you can see between, like, it became a thing for all three of those Might and Magic, 6, 7, and 8, and you can see a distinct difference if you look at the top down maps between the Might and Magic 6 version and then the Might and Magic 7 and 8 version, because I got a lot better as a level designer in that time. So I was able to more accurately create the layout of the office. And I think I actually got a blueprint or something that I could use as a guide to build it. And then, I didn't work directly on Might and Magic 8, but if you look at the sketch or the map out of like the strategy guide or something, it's the exact same level. So, they didn't want to redo the work, and they just threw in the old one, which is fine. You know, I would have done the same thing.
Well, I know that the tools, I guess you guys were using 3D Studio Max for it, or?
There was 3D Studio Max for a lot of the stuff on the art side of the house. So the characters, the sprites, they were actually sprites. They were done in 3D Studio Max. The level design was done in a proprietary program called MCAD.
Okay.
And, I think a few of the more sophisticated levels, the Tomb of Arn and those really big ones, those were done in Lightwave. So we didn't do a lot of 3DS Max. I don't even think I learned 3DS Max until I started at EA.
I just remember people massively pirating 3D Studio Max. I was wondering what you thought of like the LifTech engine as well, and what it was like to work with that, because I always loved the games and the aesthetic of that engine.
So the engine itself was great depending on what you used it for. So for games like Shogo, Mobile Armor Division, and Nolf, and Tron, like first person shooters like that, it was great. I mean, Nolf is probably one of the best games to come out of the late 90s, early 2000s. It's great LifTech for an RPG. And if you talk about Legends of Might and Magic, for a multiplayer game, it just didn't. It wasn't that good, particularly with the multiplayer aspects. It had a lot of issues with the networking. They couldn't have people in, they called them rooms, which was basically just a logical container for all the players to be in. And they couldn't have the same party in different rooms, like network rooms, in the games, and that really defeated the original concept of Legends of Might and Magic. And it turned, so they had to make it basically Fantasy Counter-Strike. For the RPGs, there was a lot of, it was a lot better suited for that, but not for the kind of open world sort of RPGs that Might and Magic was known for. Like you look at six, particularly Might and Magic 6, where you can walk from one end of the game all the way to the other. know, and back. It's very, it was very preliminary sort of open world, even though it had like little level breaks and stuff.
But they were huge open worlds as well.
Yeah, yeah. And, and if you go to, if you look at Might and Magic 9, it's it wasn't like that at all. You know, we did our best, but we had, you know, all the outdoor areas were very small, sort of tunnel kind of designs that led you from, you know, one from the little town to the load spot for the next town or a area for a quest or a dungeon. So there wasn't as much exploration just because of the nature of the engine and its draw distances and stuff like that.
Was there much else you had to consider, you know, when designing the levels and the worlds? And, you know, did it make a difference if, you know, with it being an RPG turn-based or with it being real-time combat?
Well, I was the lead designer on Might and Magic 9, so I didn't have a lot of level design input. I mean, I had the final approvals for stuff, but I don't remember any sort of thoughts between any of the games on, should we do this, focus on real-time combat for this particular level or focus on turn-based? We never did that. And we just like, you know, does the level look good? Okay, awesome. We're done.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. So the games featured a lot of digitized faces. Whose are they? Did you make it into it?
I did.
Brilliant.
So Might and Magic 6, there was two types of faces. The first was like all the main characters were basically all the employees. So the art department or the producer or something sent out an email one day and said, hey, tomorrow we're going to be taking pictures of anybody who wants to be in the game. So if you have a medieval costume, Renaissance fair garb or anything like that, come on in with it and take your picture.
Mm.
And I happened to have Renaissance fair garb.
Oh, wow.
And I was the only one of the group that had chainmail armor. So I wore my chainmail shirt and I had a chainmail hat, and they made me Woodrow the Armorsmith.
Brilliant.
And then, but everybody else that you see in the council, those are all employees. Some of the other shopkeepers and stuff were also employees. All the other faces, well, the character portraits of the player characters, those were also NPCs or also some employees.
Mm-hmm.
But then all the NPCs and random characters that you meet, those came from a CD of faces.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Just like ones you could use for free.
Yeah. And I don't know where they got it. They just had this CD that had thousands of faces and just
copyright free.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So these people might not even know that they're in the Might and Magic games.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's, play it one
you know, it's probably like, you know, somebody went around to Renaissance fairs and, hey, let me take a picture. And, hey, let me take a picture. And
Yeah,
they probably have no idea until they played the game. Hey, that's
yeah, imagine you're just playing it. It's like, is that me? That's brilliant.
Well, I was wondering what, you know, the Might and Magic games never took themselves that seriously. I was wondering what the kind of Star Trek connection was to the game.
That's the Star Trek thing started with John Van Caneghem. He was, you know, a big fan of Star Trek. Basically everybody he hired was a big fan of Star Trek. So I don't think that was planned because I don't remember a Star Trek question in my interview. But and he started throwing with like making Varn a spaceship and having nacelles. And when he passed sort of the design torch on to the rest of us throughout the different games, we just took that and went with it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So obviously the Might and Magic games were huge, you know, for what, almost 20 years, absolutely massive. But was it hard to balance the grinding of the game and then the replayability? Because obviously they're quite heavy RPGs, although they're, you know, they're quite fun and tongue in cheek, as we've discussed. Was that balance tough or did it come quite naturally?
I would say it came pretty naturally. I mean, by the time I was doing the game balancing on Might Magic 9, all that stuff had already been worked out by the previous games. So, you know, I just kind of followed the formulas and rode with it. The guys who did it, I don't remember any conversations or complaints about game balance or money or anything like that. I do remember writing up a bug that it was impossible to beat the game with an all warrior party or all night. So I started a party of all knights and I didn't want to use magic. And I said, well, I can't finish the game. That's a bug. And they told me to piss off. Like, too bad. You got to have a magic user in this game.
It was also really long as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like just doing a playthrough could be weeks and weeks and weeks.
And, you know, as a designer at the time making those levels, I didn't think those levels were particularly long. You know, I was playing Half-Life or Fallout or, you know, Quake and those games, and those levels were huge. And I remember feeling kind of inadequate as a designer when I compared my work to their work. You know, saying like, God, their levels are so big and they look so good. And, you know, this one looks like crap and it's short and it, you know, but I, you know, it worked out because the game was still 60, 70, 80 hours to finish, depending on how fast you wanted to get
through. Trying to get to those higher levels as well.
Yeah.
Like Might and Magic 7 added that like aspect of, you know, morality and like good versus evil. What did you think of that aspect when it came in?
I thought it was great. You know, it was cool being a designer for that. Cause I made both Celeste, which was the good town. And I made, I can't even remember the name, the evil town. I made both those towns. So it was cool to be able to do sort of the good and dark side of, you know, like the good town is beautiful and pretty and awesome. And then the evil town is, you know, dark and dirty. And so that was cool. And it was cool as a player because, like, you know, you're saying about replayability. Now you gotta play it twice to get both endings.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what it ended up is making it a shorter game, which at the time people kind of complained about, but you know, we had to say, look, we made the same amount of levels.
Yeah, it's tough because it's like, okay, it's a shorter game, but you have essentially built in more than one campaign. It gives it that massive replayability, you know. For me, I'm a have-to-see-everything type of person.
Yeah, me too.
So I would have to, that would mean I'd have to replay the game, whereas I have friends and, you know, co-workers and stuff who would, once they've done a game, even if it's just one campaign or from one point of view, that's it. They're done with it. They move on to the next game because they've got to see everything. So I guess it's hard to find that balance.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's you know, obviously we would want two games of the same length as Might and Magic 6, but you know, when you're a professional, you got time constraints and you got to cut things someplace.
Yeah, absolutely. And was it hard deciding on spells and new features in the game? I mean, we've just discussed one of the new features there.
Sometimes. Like, you know, when I didn't do any of the spells or any of that for Might and Magic 6 and 7, but I did on 9. You know, that was, I had to farm out the spell list to Kate, what was her title? She was my assistant designer, but that wasn't her title. She was sort of an assistant producer. Everybody wore multiple hats. I think she was actually an asset coordinator, but she sat next to me. So I gave her lots of work. So she did the spells. But I do remember having to consider all sorts of, you know, there are time constraints. How long do we have to get these features in? What's the difficulty? What's the, you know, how much fun is it going to be versus how much effort it's going to take? And so like spells, though, we had to be very cautious on how many spells were in the game. And then, you know, that applied to other things too. Like one of the first things cut out of Might and Magic 9 was the paper doll, where you could dress up your character in their equipment, and the grid-based inventory system. You know, we just went with a simple list and a couple slots for you to equip your, you know, people hated that. They were very upset that they couldn't see their character dressed up in all their equipment anymore. And it's like, well, that, you know, that takes a lot of work. And we just didn't have the time to create those assets and code making sure all the assets get in the right place at the right time. And so you're like, well, we got to cut it. And we knew it was going to suck. We knew we were going to get dinged for it, but you know, we had to get it out the door.
It was interesting with 9 because like after 6, you know, the digitization had gone out and it kind of, the graphics had changed a bit to, you know, CGI. And then 9, it was a completely new engine. What was the kind of approach there, and what was the reaction like to 9?
Well, we knew like we basically switched from sprites to full 3D models, and we knew that we weren't going to be able to have as many characters on screen, as many enemies on screen as we had in the previous games, and that was something that people really enjoyed, was fighting these hordes and hordes of monsters. And so we had to set some pretty aggressive polygon limits for all these monsters, and it made for really ugly monsters. Like if you look at, you know, Might and Magic 6 today, it has this sort of charm to it now, but you look at Might and Magic 9, and along with a lot of those other early fully 3D games, and they're still ugly. You know, yeah. Like you compare them to today's 3D standards, and it's just like, man, this guy's face is 2 polygons.
that jump to 3D was really tough for a lot of people, yeah. And a lot of companies, you know, especially on the PC and stuff. A change going from kind of sprites, like you said, to that exact rendered and everything look, but without that realism.
Yeah, and we had to do it. If we would have gone with sprite characters in a fully 3D engine, then, you know, people would have hated that. We go with 3D characters, they're going to be ugly. So
after Might and Magic, you know, we're around 2002 now, you moved to the Medal of Honor team. So you've gone from RPG to FPS. That must have been an interesting change for you. And what was it like joining the Medal of Honor team?
So it was a kind of the equivalent of leaving high school and going to college. And I don't mean, like, I'm not trying to slight New World Computing, because that was my favorite job ever. But there was sort of a step up in the professionalism or the kind of money spent on their projects. And there was a huge step up in the amount of alcohol that we had to consume. Because the design teams were, you know, we were a bunch of young guys in our late 20s or early 30s, and we all still wanted to go out and party, and you know, we had the money to do it, and so we did it. But in terms of, like, as a designer, there was that, because I'd been a designer on a 3D game, the design, like the concepts really translated well. If I had jumped from, like, say, Might and Magic to Command and Conquer, then I think I would have struggled a lot more than going into a first person shooter. There was a little bit of I guess easierness, is that a word?
Yeah.
Because the levels were in a, you know, they were a linear fashion. We didn't have to worry about you know, how strong the player was going to be at this particular junction. We knew that they were going to be X strength, you know, they would have X weapons in this level, so we could balance it a lot easier. And then there was a lot of design processes that had to be relearned. At the time, you know, EALA used to be DreamWorks Interactive, and it was a Steven Spielberg sort of invention, and so there was a lot of sort of crossover between the film industry and the game industry. And a lot of the film people who had moved into the games were trying to apply the same sort of processes from making a film into making a game.
Yeah.
And it was our job as designers to see this kind of bullshit that we kind of looked at it as at the time, and apply that as useful information to making a game.
Yeah.
And, you know, like if you're writing a movie, you focus on things like beats and big moments and character development that you're not necessarily as interested in for a game. But we did take good things, like, okay, we want a big set piece here in the game. So let's kind of draw step by step how you get there. But it was a definite adjustment for me. I was used to sort of lead game designer coming into my room and saying, okay, the level is called this. It's called Rivendell, and it's over a river. Go build it. You know, whereas at EA, we had a full design document, and we had very specific beats, particularly making a history game, because basically all the levels came from real historical events. Yeah. So we had to follow the history, which wasn't something we had to do on Might and Magic's.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously, moving into Medal of Honor, you know, you kind of mentioned a lot more drinking there. It sounded like a kind of different atmosphere a little bit as well. Do you think, because by this point, Medal of Honor is kind of like, I think maybe on its third game, when it kind of came to the PS2, it might have been its fourth. And do you think there was a lot of pressure there from EA for it to be a big title? Because all of a sudden, you know, it's next gen, it's PlayStation 2, it's Xbox. Was that quite stressful, or did you? It sounded like maybe you just kind of got on with things.
So, in a single word, yes, there were big expectations for Rising Sun and Pacific Assault, because Medal of Honor was just coming off of Allied Assault, which, if you ask me, is still the best game in the series. It just it was a masterpiece, and it was huge success commercially. And so they came to us and said, you know, we're making the new Medal of Honor. It's going to be in the Pacific Theater. And they expected it to outsell the best-selling game of the previous year. And that was like just like straight from the get-go. We're going to sell 6 million copies of this game.
Yeah.
So it better be good. And so there were a lot of late nights. I think that on Medal of Honor, I did a year and a half of 80-hour weeks.
Oh, wow.
Without a break. I had never had that much overtime, unpaid overtime. I never had worked that hard, basically ever. So, and, you know, the drinking was, I think, part of that was a coping mechanism for basically being, deployed, if you will. You know, because we were all away from our families, we were away from our friends, we were away from basically everything was the job.
Yeah.
And
so you kind of felt like you were at war anyway.
I mean, you know, I don't want to get close to kind of presuming that we knew what it was like, but it was kind of similar circumstances in terms of our home lives,
like that kind of isolation.
I
was looking at Frontline, and the soundtrack is just absolutely amazing with that kind of orchestral score and stuff. There were loads of other elements as well. What do you think really made the atmosphere of the game amazing?
With Frontline?
Yeah.
It's...
And that D-Day landing as well.
D-Day. I mean, D-Day and Frontline is great, but it still doesn't hold a candle to the Allied Assault D-Day. There's just something about... I think because it's on a PC, or at the time, the PCs were more powerful than the PlayStation, so you could do more. But to me, it comes down to the level design and the set pieces. So, you know, the set pieces were different parts of each level. There had to be very specific things that we wanted to do. So, like in the D-Day, obviously the set piece is D-Day, is that getting off the beach and onto the, or getting off the LVT onto the beach and having everybody shoot at you, very Saving Private Ryan kind of moment.
Normandy landings.
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. And I think that was a real important part of the atmosphere, along with the pacing. The pacing of all the Medal of Honor games is always really good. You know, you had these big action moments, but then you had kind of paced moments where you're just kind of walking down a hallway waiting for something to shoot or something like that. There wasn't really a lot of puzzle solving in it, but that really, I think that was a big reason for its success.
Yeah, there was a good balance with it, and it was one of the first games I ever saw on PS2, and I remember it felt real. Like, you know, it was like, oh my god, you know, I was quite young at the time. I would have been a young teenager, and I remember, like you say, it kind of had that Saving Private Ryan feel to it and stuff. And that first level was so grand, but then the rest of the game was so immersive as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had the civilians in there, and it, as you said, it was real world set pieces and stuff. I guess there was an aim to not make light of the war.
Yeah, it was impressed upon us very strictly that, you know, we had Dale Dye, who was our military advisor, and he was also the military advisor for Saving Private Ryan. And he was a Marine, like in capital letters. And he was, you know, he was very serious about the respect that we had to have for the soldiers and the things that they did and stuff like that. Not that we would have made light of it anyway, but yeah, he is very serious about stuff like that. Like if we didn't have even, I don't even think we had anything approved that would have been silly or referential to other forms of media or something like that. Like we would have on Might and Magics, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember playing Medal of Honor Rising Sun and that intro, Pearl Harbor, where it's all completely calm and then suddenly it just blows up and it's really chucks you into the action. That's one of the kind of great moments that I had when gaming. What was the whole kind of idea? Was it just to, you know, get people going, but also, you know, celebrate that, well, not celebrate it, but also, you know, refer to that point of history and how much of a surprise attack it was and kind of impactful?
Well, we kind of had to top the Normandy invasion and Allied assault. There was, you know, we had to have something that was as big. And that was the first key. It's got to be great. The second key was that it had to be accurately portrayed as to what really happened. You know, the first thing that all of us designers did when we first started was we got a stack of books we had to read. Band of Brothers and the Iwo Jima books, the Flags of Our Fathers, and all like just everything. All these books, I'd never read so many World War II books. And the funny thing is that the majority of the ones that we read were still European theater stuff. I mean, we did read like Ghost Soldiers. That was my level. We read a lot of the Pacific theater stuff after that. And so we almost became, before I even got a computer, I read probably 16 books. And so we all kind of became little tiny experts of World War II at the time.
I think, you know, Pearl Harbor in American culture, it's obviously it's very well known, but in the UK, you know, we focus on like kind of our side of the war, and seeing that from that aspect was absolutely amazing. And also, you know, just the ships collapsing in there and having to try and navigate around the chaos. It was a real kind of, as you mentioned Spielberg earlier, it was a real set piece kind of film.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if I could kind of toot our own horn a little bit, I actually think that the Pearl Harbor scene in both in Rising Sun and Pacific Assault was better than the Pearl Harbor movie.
I think it's one of the greatest scenes I've played in a video game, you know.
So how important was the accuracy of the weapons? You know, we've nailed the feel of the game, you know, the kind of like the history of the game and stuff. The actual gameplay itself, the feel of the weapons, the accuracy of them, you know, the equipment you're using. How important was that?
So it was really important, but it did kind of take a backseat to the gameplay. Mm. So like we had to use historically accurate weapons, you know, we had to use stuff that the soldiers would have had at the time, but we didn't necessarily have to represent those weapons precisely how it would have been actually used. So like in one of the levels, we had a tank buster gun. There's a player walking around with this 50-pound rifle, you know, and like, no way. That's not going to happen, you know, but it made for good gameplay. So it had to take a backseat. One place where accuracy was supremely important was in the AI, and both the AI of the enemies and the AI of any followers that the player had. So we actually had to take a few classes in a World War II military strategy, both from the Marines' point of view, so the Marine strategies, and from the Japanese strategies. And it was all taught by Dale Dye, you know, our military advisor, and he showed us all the different tactics that the Marines used, different tactics that the Japanese used. And then our culmination of all of this, we all had to, it was terrible. We had to take a day off of work and go to a paintball field. and he divided us up into different squads and different battalions. And then, you know, he said, okay, in this scenario, you guys are the Japanese and you guys are the Marines, and you have to use those specific tactics that you were taught and fight each other.
I think like elements like the kamikaze and stuff were pretty, like, when you're playing, you're like really shocked by it.
And you know, it's funny
how impactful it is.
That's one thing that we really, like, it really ingrained in us. Like, I was always a Marine in our paintball experience, but so I faced down a bunch of kamikazes, and you know, there was a lot of like laughing and fun about it. But the one thing that we really impressed is, or what was impressed on us, when you're sitting there experiencing it, when, you know, there's paintballs flying by your head, but they still, you know, you still hear, you know, the whizzing by. So there's a bit of like, oh, keep your head down. And it really showed us how, both how, scary that is, and how just utterly futile it was for the Japanese. Cause you know, we had, you know, one, the one rule of the Japanese soldiers was, in lieu of other orders, attack. And so if their commander got killed, they would bonsai. And we shot their commander and they bonsaied. And
that's in a Pacific assault, isn't it? They have that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And in this particular, in the paintball instances, they all ran and Gaul got mowed down and we didn't have any casualties. But another interesting thing about that is there was a particular point where my squad was kind of, they were pinned down. And at the time I was a big paintball guy and I was sick of just sitting still. So, you know, you could look at it as our commander was afraid and wasn't doing his job. And so I said, you know what, F this, I'm going to attack. And so I yelled up at the guys in my squad, said, follow me. And I ran and I started charging down to the next set of barricades or cover. And, you know, they all came with me and it was getting ready. We're like, we moved forward until there was only one more bunker between us and the enemy. And I wanted to get down there. I wanted to take those people out and get them in a crossfire and wipe them all out. And, you know, I wasn't in command, but I was given the orders. And so I said, okay, I'm going to, you know, cover me. I'm going to go up as soon as there's a little break in the fire. And then we're going to destroy them. And so I peeped my head up to look to, you know, to keep an eye on when it was okay to shoot. And I got shot right in the face.
Cool.
And, you know, I had a mask on, so you know, there was no problems there, but I had to leave. And after I went and these guys suddenly had nobody giving them orders, they just stayed there. And it eventually the exercise turned into a stalemate. And Captain Dye afterwards is like, you know, you had something really interesting developing on the left flank and then it just all stopped. And that's something that would have happened in a real war. You know, if a commander gets killed, suddenly nobody knows what to do. And on the American side, they always had a very specific, you know, if your commander gets killed, then you're in command kind of thing, which is not something the Japanese had.
Yeah. Yeah. Disperse, run away kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay. So obviously, you know, Medal of Honor took quite a bit of a turn, you know, kind of towards the late 2000s and obviously with Call of Duty and stuff like that. But Call of Duty, obviously, it started in the early 2000s as well. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of having an effect on Medal of Honor at the time, you know, when you were working on them, or did you pay any attention to what Call of Duty was doing?
Oh, yeah. The original team that started Call of Duty, there were a company called Spark Entertainment, and they were all ex-EA employees. Like most of those guys did Frontline and Allied Assault. So, you know, they Activision basically hired them to come over to defect.
Yeah.
To start Call of Duty. So, you know, as the guys left standing and I was hired on after that. So I didn't get as much of it, but there was a lot of let's bury them. Let's make this game so much better than their game kind of thing. And, but you know, we all played the first Call of Duty. We played it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and we're like, oh, they did this little, you know, mouse over the guy and it tells you his name kind of thing. That's really cool. And, you know, having separate AIs doing different things where like, you know, you got a corpsman who's going to come and heal you if you get hurt. And that stuff was, you know, a lot of those mechanics made their way into Medal of Honor after that.
I was wondering, like, is there a time period or a kind of battle in history that you would have loved Medal of Honor to cover?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first would have been the raid on Cabanatuan, which was in the original design for Rising Sun. And they eventually made it into a movie called The Great Raid. And it's basically, it was a prison camp.
Right.
That was at the result of the Bataan Death March. So the Battle of Bataan very early in the war, the Americans and I think there was some English soldiers there too, that they lost basically and they surrendered. And the Japanese marched them halfway across the Philippines to this prison camp, and they spent the rest of the war there. And near the end of the war, right, basically as soon as MacArthur set foot on the Philippines, they sent soldiers to rescue them. And it's a very dramatic sort of thing. And I really wish that level would have made it into the game. Alongside with that, I wish it's a very sensitive topic, but I wish we would have done a level on like Auschwitz or Dachau or one of the prison camps or the concentration camps, not because it would be a particularly fun or exciting level, but I think that history, particularly with World War II history, is really important. And I wish we would have shown like the gravity of that.
Like the liberation and the kind of discovery.
Yeah. And I mean, it, as a designer, it would be very hard to frame that as a level with, you know, like having a satisfactory victory at the end where everybody can feel good when, you know, you're seeing the horrors of the prison camp. But, you know, sometimes I don't think you need that. I think you really, and it's something that even today games shy away from, is really heavy topics like that, where it's,
that's why I love the Medal of Honor series, because it was historically accurate, but also it really added emotion to the games as well.
Yeah, I blame the soundtrack for that, man. Those soundtracks were always so
stunning,
weepy and sweepy. That's what we call you know.
Before we finish, I was just wondering what you're up to nowadays. Then,
so now I've got a little indie company that's it's called Dungeon Byte Softworks, and I've been working on a sort of, I guess you could call it a spiritual successor to Might and Magic. It's called Aelwyn's Legacy, and it's basically just another sort of blobber game, is what they call them now. We didn't call it then, but a party-based role-playing game set in the first person. And we're in a kind of a holding pattern while we're revamping our sort of game engine, game mechanics to be less bloated. They were very kind of fat and bloated, and we're in the middle of that. And we got some good screenshots and stuff, but we don't have a release date yet, but it's fun to kind of revisit the fantasy RPG genre again.
Well, when it does come out, let us know.
Yeah, for sure.
Give you a shout or get you on the show.
Yeah, you can just go to, like, if you want to check it out or see any screenshots, you can go to dungeonbyte.com, and it's BYTE.
Awesome. Well, Tim, it's been an amazing interview. We've covered so much in this.
Thank you so much for coming on. I should have warned you. I like to tell stories.
We love talkers.
Awesome.
So, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.